The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone, and welcome back to our last class. And I thought it would be good to start again with any questions you might have, or mostly questions or reports with how it's going with your practice. And anything you'd like me to address today? Everything seems clear, straightforward. Anything you want to ask about your own meditation practice and questions you have about it or challenges?
Just when we get the hang of the microphone, the class will be over. So I don't know how to articulate this challenge, but for some reason this week I found it actually just harder than usual to simply sit down and do it. And I'm not sure why. And I guess my question then is, when that happens, is there a way to figure out what's blocking, or is there a way of approaching it, or is the solution just do it anyway? I mean, if I could just do it anyway, then I would just do it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, I'm sure there's some reason, you know, something in my head that's making me hesitate, and I don't know how to find it.
Good. It's good. It's a great question. And it's well worth investigating the blocks to meditation practice, what gets in the way. And there's a whole range of things that could be the cause. Some of it has to do with laziness. You know, it just takes a little bit extra effort. We're busy. We're doing all our stuff in our life. Other things seem compelling for whatever reason. And it's hard to kind of interrupt the flow of all the compelling activities, to step out of it and do something as nothing as meditating. You know, sometimes it's laziness, sometimes it's the attraction of everything else. You know, it's hard to, sometimes it's the compelling nature of everything else. There's fear. I have to do a lot of stuff, and the fear drives us to keep going and not stopping. It could be desire. You want something and really want, and we don't want to stop and meditate. Sometimes it has to do with resistance. And sometimes meditation is not good news. Sometimes meditation requires us to confront difficult parts of our life, things we'd rather not have to face. And so sometimes when the insights we get from meditation causes us to realize we have to change something in our life, but I don't want to change it. So I'd rather not meditate because I'm reminded of this. Sometimes meditation gives rise to new values in people. And those values are disruptive for our life. So, for example, when I was a new meditator, I was living on a farm with a couple of friends. And so that was a rural farm. Basically, that was our community, the three of us, the couple and I. And I started meditating, and meditation was quite nice for me. Every morning I'd get up and meditate. And I felt quite beautifully empty, like I didn't have to be my gill. I would come down to breakfast with my friends in this beautiful, relaxed, peaceful way. I didn't feel like I didn't have to do anything. But they expected the old guild to be there and be able to play the old kind of social games that we played nicely together, but still the old kind of personas and stuff. And I had no need for that. And I realized after a while that I had a choice of either losing my friends or giving up meditation. And so I gave up the meditation. And later, because I was so new to all this, later I learned how to negotiate those two worlds. So learning to be kind of in a nicely empty and be connected to people. But it took me a while to learn that. So sometimes we get changed and we don't know how to deal with that change. And so it takes a while. And what I didn't know, which I eventually learned, is one of the ways to negotiate something like that is to tell people. Share, you know, that, tell them, you know, I'm not sure, you know, I'm meditating and I feel a little different than I usually do. I feel good, don't worry about me. And perhaps, you know, it's going to take me a little while to figure out how to be here with you in the new way. If I told my friends that, they would have been very supportive, but I didn't have enough sense at 21 to say that. And sometimes I know people, you know, in meditation there are sometimes deep issues in oneself, unresolved issues that come up in meditation. Deep fears, deep memories of things that come up that we'd rather not look at. Ethical transgressions we wish we had forgotten, that we were reminded because somehow things... And so then there's a desire not to meditate. Some people don't want to meditate because the mind is quite powerful to keep us distracted. And so we're always trying to, you know, to come back and be present, but the mind keeps taking us away. And meditation is kind of like baseball, where, you know, in baseball, a really good player fails 2/3 of the time, you know, at bat. That's a good player, you know, excellent player fails 2/3 of the time. Well, excellent meditators fail, you know, you know, a lot also. You know, the mind wanders off and you come back and wanders off. So if you're success-driven, if that's kind of how a person measures their well-being or their whatever, meditation is not very good activity because most of the time you're going to fail. But failing is not really failing. Failing, you know, the fact that the mind wanders off, shouldn't be seen as failure. It just means that we're kind of learning to work the mind, and we have to work it and come back. But it's very easy to see to judge our meditation as being a failure. It doesn't live up to the standards we have. Some people have very lofty standards for meditation, and they expect themselves to sit down and be a Buddha by Saturday. I think meditation is really helped by great humility or humbleness, you know, not to be so idealistic about it, but be very realistic. We're trying to meet ourselves as we are. So excessive idealism can discourage people and then they don't want to meditate anymore. So those are some ideas. Any of those speak to you? Or are they...
Yes, and I mean, all of them in some way, of course, at different times. But I think in this case, it's definitely something, an aversion about wanting to sit down. And I haven't yet realized what I'm trying to avoid specifically.
Yeah.
But probably there's just something there that I don't want to take the time to be aware of yet.
Yeah. So you could sit down and with that as the task, to look at that. And if meditation is, you know, you can't get to meditate, go sit in a quiet chair in the corner of your house. It's okay, I don't want to meditate. Let me just sit down quietly now and really look at, or go for a walk around the block. And let me just kind of hang with this feeling. And maybe rather than think about it, another approach is to feel your way into it. So if there's aversion or resistance or something, feel your way into the body, into what the resistance and aversion feels like in your body. Just feel your way like you're feeling going in the dark and really get close to it. And then it might speak to you. Then it might show itself to you.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
So I know the reason that... I think I know the reason why I don't meditate in my house. The only time I ever meditate is when I come here. And it's fear. The only place I think in my house that I think would be safe to meditate is in the bathroom. It's 5x7. You can close the door and it's a small enough space. There's too much space in my house to close my eyes and feel safe. But I feel safe around other people.
But you're alone in your house?
Yes.
So somehow the alone space, the solitude. So that's something really, I think, significant for you to practice with and work with. And certainly it's fine to meditate in your bathroom.
But I think it's weird to be afraid to meditate in your own house.
No, you know, in meditation circles like this kind of circle here, nothing is weird.
Okay.
You know, it's just you know, it's not helpful even to see it as weird. It's how I am. It's how what's going on with me. And the task in meditation is to meet yourself as you are. And that's a great understanding. I commend you. Seriously, that is really great that you see it. And now, having seen it, your task is to somehow work with that. And how to work with it is your task. Some people would choose to choose the most scary place in the whole house and sit down there and sit for 40 minutes or half an hour, and even if you break out into a sweat, and I'm just going to deal with this. That some people would take that approach. Some people, that's the completely wrong approach. Some people would be, I'm going to learn to meditate in my bathroom with the door locked. And then after a week, maybe I can sit in my bathroom and unlock the door. And then after another week, what I'll do is I'll open the door slightly. And after another month or two, I'll open the bathroom door completely. And then maybe I'll meditate in the hallway. And slowly, you know.
That's too scary.
But exploring a little bit outside of meditation, inside meditation, a little bit this whole terrain of fear. First, maybe consider what would it take to feel safe enough to begin having a dialogue with your fear. To have a conversation with it. Would it take coming here? Would it take finding a friend? Would it be with a therapist? But to kind of get in dialogue with it. Chances are that if your fear is not helped by you being afraid of it. So your fear will be helped when you stop being afraid of it. Yeah, here, please, right behind you, the mic.
Okay. I have a problem of not being afraid of anything. I have a problem of the more I meditate, the less need I have to be with other people. I don't know, I became like almost antisocial.
From meditation? Or just from life?
Just for other people, being with other people, doing things. I'm becoming like a hermit.
Okay.
So
is there a problem with that?
Well, when I'm not sort of meditating, and my friends kind of stopped calling me from, you know, just like
people,
because I don't bring myself out.
And what's the problem with that? What's the problem you've seen around that?
Well, that seemed to be abnormal.
Oh, it's just an idea that it's abnormal.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you put aside the idea that it's abnormal,
I'm perfectly happy.
And are some of your friends and family complaining?
Well, yes. Just this week, one of my friends called and says, "What's going on? We never see you anymore. Uh-huh. You never call or anything, and I kind of don't know what to say. Just I don't need you anymore." Yeah.
So I don't know what's happening with you, but I can say a few things. One is that some problems in people that people have in life is not with the issue. The problem is the interpretation of the issue, the ideas, the judgments we have about it. So it sounds like, in and of itself, you have no trouble, but it's the ideas that you should be different, which is causing you some distress. So that's an important difference, and then you can. So the issue maybe is not so much your desire to be alone, but the issue is the judgments you have about that, the worries you have about that. The other thing is that human beings go through phases. And people who are on a spiritual path go through phases, and their life changes over time. What, you know, different phases call for different things. And it's completely healthy to go through phases of being much more solitary and being much more social and going back and forth. Different things happen. Different parts of our growth happens in these different modes. And also, as people get older, which I think is happening to you as well, is that as we get older, some people find that it's natural to want to spend less time being social as something else begins to happen. Some people find that being alone is fallow time. Fallow time is a traditional idea for something to ripen or develop. If you're doing mindfulness practice, at some point, if you're spending too much time alone and it becomes a problem, you'll notice some feeling of uneasiness with it, some feeling of something is off, and then you can correct for it. That's my thought. How does that sound to you? And you might need to tell your friends what's going on with you. You might, you know, put it in a little lofty language for them and say, you're going through your spiritual phase. You know, and then, oh, okay, you know. There was a great story of a man who came, older man who came to IMC some years ago. And he came and did an intro class and was practicing here for a year or so. And then he came and told me that his kids were really worried. Came to him and said they were really worried about him. Said, are you okay? Are you some kind of illness? Something serious going on with you? And maybe you should see a doctor or something? And the story was that he had spent his whole life being nervous and always kind of a nervous guy. And that's how his kids always knew him, as a nervous guy, right? They grew up with him that way. And after a year of meditation, he stopped being nervous. And it disoriented the family. What's wrong with that? Yes?
I'm sure a question about...
Can you wait for the mic, please?
Back to her general, her question about going into a smaller room. Is there a general problem with people who have to go into a smaller room, or it's just one-to-one?
Is there a problem with it?
Well, you know, like you're afraid the world's going to come in. I mean, is that why they go into such a small space?
She said she feels safe that way. So safety is safety. So it varies from person to person. I wouldn't want to generalize. And I also wouldn't want to start with the assumption that it's a problem. It just... I wouldn't start the assumption it's a problem, even for her. But she's concerned, and she has fear she's trying to deal with. But generally, I just want to make the point that generally in mindfulness practice, we would say the idea that things are a problem is a secondary abstraction. And we're more interested in actually not so much having that judgment, it's a problem. What is it? And really kind of connect more deeply. And as I think sometimes, some of our so-called problems are distressing for us because we've called them problems. And they might be something that needs to be addressed, something needs to be changed, but to call it a problem, you know, there's a lot of things which our society calls problems maybe shouldn't be problems. And we've seen that, for example, with children who have we call it learning disabilities. But some of the learning disabilities are only disabilities because of how our culture is designed. And in other cultures and times, they would have excelled in their culture for their abilities. And you know, we call them learning disabilities. But so my son has dyslexia. And when we studied the issue when he was young and then told him that he has dyslexia, he didn't realize it himself. He was told that he had a gift. And then he did this dyslexia program where they treated it as a gift, the special ability he had. And there was this really cool guy who had dyslexia, who was his teacher. And he thought that he was like his hero, you know, my son, it's a great, cool guy. So was this dyslexia a gift or is it a problem? You know, it was my son's case was better, more useful for him to think that he had a gift when he was 7 years old than that he had a problem. So this idea of problems, we all got problems. Or we have no problems. Which would you rather have it be? There's no problems, but things we have to be mindful of and learn about and try to address. So I think that part of what we try to get across when people do mindfulness practice is that there's a very generous, a very broad attitude of acceptance, self-acceptance, acceptance of things as they are, acceptance of life, acceptance of others, that comes with the mindfulness. And we're not here to add these judgments and ideas and interpretations on top, but to meet life as it actually is and to be very accepting of it. It doesn't mean that we accept things that should not be accepted, you know, violence and people treating each other badly or whatever. But even when there's, you know, people, you know, there's a kind of a, an open heart, an open accepting, kind of open-heartedness that's part of the mindfulness, rather than seeing things as problems or wrong. And so people have all kinds of unique situations, and everyone's unique. And you could say everyone's weird, except for you. You know, everyone's odd. You know, it's or no one's odd. It's just people are what they are. You know, and it's okay to be who we are. And so it's part of the beauty of this. As we sit down to meditate, we're here to kind of really connect and allow for who we are, and then work with that and find and discover that's workable. It's something that we can work with and work through and find some freedom from and with. The fact that someone says that they're afraid of something, you know, my first response to someone who says that is, or my first feeling is, I'm impressed that they know that part of themselves. This is really great. They recognize this and see it. And that's the beginning. That's part of that, you know. Okay, so let's do it. So let's do a meditation. And as a, like to, as an introduction to this meditation, I'd like to say that in Buddhism, mindfulness has two, is seen sometimes as a faculty meaning a capacity, a functioning of the mind that we can activate and use. So it's a faculty that we can use. And it's also a power. If that faculty is used, and used on a regular basis, then at some point it becomes a power that we carry with us, a strength that we carry with us. So rather, it's, you know, the faculty is very meaningful faculty and useful faculty. We can call on it and use it whenever we can, whenever it's useful. But as we use it more and more, it begins to develop, just like a muscle would develop. And so after a while it becomes like a strength or a power that that we don't have to call upon to use, but it's just there. It just kind of follows us along. Becomes like a companion or a force that's here with us. You know, some of you probably had the experience maybe of exercising and somehow getting really feeling good exercise, and when the exercise program is over, you feel this kind of power, strength coursing through you. You feel kind of more buoyant and alive, and you feel this force almost, force field, I don't know. And so as we do the mindfulness and get into it and develop it more and more, we start noticing that it's not just a faculty that we activate, but it's a force or a power that supports us, carries us along. So take a comfortable and alert posture. If you're tired and you feel like what you most want to do is to collapse, it might actually be more useful for you to sit up straighter. And gently close your eyes. And before doing anything else, if you tune in to yourself, recognize how you are right now, what needs acceptance? What about yourself, what about now, that you can be open-hearted towards? Allowing, this is who I am now, this is what's happening. And not be in conflict with it. Allow it to be. and perhaps with a kind of a global sense of yourself here. In the middle of that globe is your spine. Feel your spine, the vertebrae of your spine, your sitting bones against a chair, your cushion, and the center column coming up from base of your spine up into the base of your skull. And perhaps you can feel what happens in your spine as you breathe. The movement, the oscillation. And then taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. As you exhale, softening and relaxing around that column of your spine, staying upright, but relaxing anything extra, any holding. Perhaps you can soften your belly. Perhaps soften the muscles of your chest. And perhaps the shoulders can be relaxed, shoulder blades. And then noticing the muscles of your face, relaxing the jaws, letting the flesh and muscles of your face fall away from the bones. And then within your body, as part of your bodily experience, notice how the body experiences breathing. Breathing in and breathing out. There's your breathing, the experience of breathing, and there's the awareness of breathing. Your awareness meets your breathing, and awareness of breathing occurs. Stay with the knowing of what's happening, knowing the breath, the in-breath, the out-breath, knowing sounds, knowing thinking. Stay in the flow of knowing, of recognizing, of being aware. Hearing. In order for your awareness to be all-encompassing, what is it that you might be ignoring? What is it that might need to be accepted? So you can be more fully here. mindfulness practice is supported by trusting the mindfulness, by trusting that all you need to do is to know what is happening right now. Don't have to think about it or figure anything out or think about anything else. Staying with the simplicity of just knowing this, what's happening now, this breath, the sound, the sensation, this thought, clearly knowing it, acknowledging it. And whatever it is you're mindful of at any given moment, be mindful of it. Know it's there. Recognize it. And let yourself register more fully the experience. Take it in. Get to know it better. Doesn't that mean that you linger for a long time necessarily, but each thing gets its due attention until the next thing happens, the next part of the breath. So it's a beautiful thing when mindfulness becomes a power or strength that we carry with us, or it carries us along. Because then mindfulness is not something you have to do so much as you have to allow for. It's there. There's a kind of strength of attention, of awareness, of presence. Strength of presence, it's there. And it's very interesting when there's a kind of strength of awareness which is there. that it also begins to shift a little bit who we think we are. You know, or shift a little bit where we think, you know, what we have to be doing all the time, or a sense of personal responsibility that it's up to me to fix everything or be mindful, or that I have to always be thinking about things or analyzing things or daydreaming about things, that there's something, there's a kind of a presence almost that we carry with us, that carries us, that kind of supports our life. And it's a place where we can rest, or a place where we can abide, or it can be a place where we can find our orientation in life. It's a, it's something, it's a kind of a part of us, part of ourselves, which is not our normal, maybe, small self, or egotistical self, or self-centered self, or, you know, cognitive self, but something that's larger or bigger, or something that's not, doesn't belong necessarily to this, to the world of self-preoccupation. Some people, when the sense of mindfulness gets strong, or the sense of power of presence gets strong, sometimes will anthropomorphize that feeling. That, and sometimes they'll even say, some people will call it, you know, the presence of God, because what else could it be? But it's this very strong sense of awareness or attention, which can be quite large, very spacious, very open, or very strong, that kind of becomes more important than almost anything else that goes on. So one of the secrets, of mindfulness practice, is that mindfulness is developed as the best chance to develop and become the strength, become stronger for us, if there's a continuity of practice. If we practice it, you know, every day, meditate 20 minutes a day or something, that's great. It's wonderful. But if we meditate two times 20 minutes a day, then we're training ourselves more, developing it more. If we're doing mindfulness all the time in our daily activity, then that chance of that of momentum starts to build and become stronger and stronger. You know, I've had the experience of exercising, like I started running. You know, the first 300 yards, I just wanted to give up. You know, I don't want to do this. But then after those first 300 yards, then, you know, something kicked in, it got easier. But then after, you know, it just felt like in the beginning, it just felt like I had these lead boots on, or just this, all this resistance in my muscles, like, I don't want to do this. And I noticed that after, over the days, that not only did the resistance and kind of the in my body drop away, but after a while, with the running, it kind of began kind of like having a life of its own, and it's more like the body was running. It wasn't an act of will anymore. As long as it was an act of will, like I was forcing my body to, my mind was forcing my body to run, it was kind of tiring for me, or, you know, I didn't always want to do it, and I'd get bored pretty easily. But once the body was running, and it kind of was conditioned enough and developed enough and strong enough and had some kind of stamina, kind of like, I feel like I'd get into this kind of groove, right? Something would click. And then, you know, it was easy to run. I could run. I was surprised how far I could run sometimes, and I wasn't bored. Why was I bored? I was running, you know, four times as long as I did at the beginning when I was bored, and now I wasn't bored. It's because, you know, something clicks. So mindfulness is the same way, that the more you practice it, something begins to click after a while, and it starts to carry us along, and it becomes easier and easier, like we're in the groove, it happens more. So the secret for the grooving on mindfulness, fitting in, you know, settling into it, is the continuity, just like with exercise, doing it a lot. And so then looking for appropriate opportunities in our life to practice more of it is something that's very appealing to many people. And what I'd like to talk about is one particular area where mindfulness can be cultivated outside of meditation that you might find interesting to, and that is with walking. When you walk, and maybe not at all the places and every time you walk, but there might be situations in daily life where you're walking actually could be a opportune time, wonderful time, to do mindfulness practice. And if you're honest about, you know, so for example, when you walk, like if you park your car, I don't know, your place of work perhaps, and you have to walk from the parking lot to your office, maybe it's a 5-minute walk. And that 5-minute walk could be a period of walking meditation. And if you're honest about, if you don't do walking meditation, if you just do life as usual, and notice what goes on in your mind, you probably, chances are that it's not that productive or useful or what goes on during those 5 minutes. Maybe it is for you, but you know, there's a lot of unuseful things that your mind does. And so it might be more useful actually to use that 5 minutes for walking meditation. Walking meditation is also something to be done, like if you're waiting. If you're waiting for something to happen, like you're getting your oil changed for your car, you could look at the car magazines they have there. That could be, you know, very educational. Or you could just you know, do walking meditation out in the parking lot. You can do it so people don't know what you're doing. He's pacing out there. Why is she pacing? And it might be qualitatively 10 minutes in the oil change parking lot might be as meaningful as 10 minutes of meditating at home. You can really get still and concentrated and centered and present in a very nice way. Walking meditation is a big part of our mindfulness tradition. It's mostly associated with, our tradition is mostly associated with sitting meditation, and that's mostly what we emphasize here in IMC. And however, what's often not kind of made more public is that walking meditation is really a big deal in our tradition. And especially if you go on retreats. Our meditation retreats, we do equal amount of time for walking meditation as we do sitting meditation. Some people, they find that walking meditation works better for them for cultivating mindfulness than sitting meditation. Or certain times of life, it's much better to go do walking meditation. Sometimes there's a lot of energy, emotional energy, a lot of energy, you know, a lot of turmoil in our life. Sometimes it's, you know, sit down to meditate and we kind of just caught up in that turmoil and all the energy. But if you do walking meditation, there's something about the walking which kind of holds the energy, holds the strong feelings or emotions or whatever, in a much nicer way, that it's possible to get centered more easily perhaps than sitting. Walking meditation is a wonderful thing to do as a complement to sitting meditation. If you want to have a longer period of mindfulness session, like say you sit at home for 30 minutes and you feel like that's all the length of time that your knees can handle. You know, I can't do more than 30 minutes, but I'd like to be able to meditate more. Then you can do, that more can be in the form of walking meditation. Spares your knees, perhaps, and gives you a chance to do a longer period of meditation. There's a famous story in our Vipassana tradition, I hope I didn't tell you guys this, but I told this before, of a woman who had 4 children who had gone on a meditation retreat. At the end of the retreat, the teacher said to her something like, well, when you get home, it's really important to meditate every day. You know, spend 45 minutes meditating every day or whatever. And she went up to him and said, I can't do that. It's impossible. He said, oh, of course it's possible. Everyone should be able to carve out, you know, a period of time to meditate in the morning. You don't understand, it's not possible. And then she had enough wherewithal, she invited him to come and live with her for a while, for a week or something. And she was a single mom with 4 kids. And after a day or two of kind of following her around, he said, you're right. You can't meditate. It doesn't work. So what he did was he then followed her around, and as she went about her daily life, he taught her how to be mindful in her daily activities. When she was washing dishes at the sink, how to really be there, so it was a mindfulness meditation as opposed to just washing dishes and thinking about your taxes or the kids or something. But in her house, there was a hallway that connected all the rooms. So she had to walk through that hallway many times during the day. So he said, okay, this hallway is becoming your meditation hall. And whenever you step into this hallway, you do walking meditation to get to wherever you're going in that hallway. And she said this was really meaningful for her. And she did this for years until her kids were old enough so that she could go on a meditation retreat again. And when she did, she had so much momentum, so much power in her mindfulness that she kind of, you know, she was had a very, very powerful retreat because her mindfulness was so strong. So walking is something very ordinary that we all do, and so it's something that you know, if you want to bring mindfulness more to your normal life, walking is a great place to begin experimenting with that. Walking meditation is done as a meditation practice of finding a walkway that's about 20 or 30 paces long and simply walking back and forth. And the speed with which you walk is up to you. And I suggest people choose a pace, a speed, which brings you a sense of ease. So the first task in walking meditation, just establish a speed going back and forth, but it gives you some sense of ease, nothing dramatic, some modicum of ease. When some people, when they're really angry, will go for a walk, because even though it doesn't, you know, somehow it helps bring some ease or spaciousness or somehow a more satisfying way of being. And, you know, maybe if you're angry, you walk fast. You know, that's what works best. So any pace at all works. My teacher in Burma, whenever I saw him doing walking meditation, he was power walking. I had to kind of run, you know, to keep up with him, back and forth. You know, it was quite something to watch. And so that's allowed. You can, you know, power walk, you know, race back and forth. And I've done that sometimes when I had a lot of difficult energies arising when I was meditating, and I just couldn't sit still. And the only way I could handle it was I just paced back and forth really fast, back and forth in the meditation monastery. So, or it can be really slow, or it could be a street pace, or it could be any pace. So it is, your job is to find a pace that gives you some sense of ease. And then once you have that sense of ease, is to begin settling your attention into your body. It's a physical meditation. It's very clearly involves sensory awareness, sensation awareness, kinesthetic awareness, being aware of somatic experiencing, what's going on in your body as you walk. So not thinking about it, but sensing and feeling, almost from the inside. Some people find walking meditation is very helpful because it involves movement and more bigger movements than sitting meditation. It's easier to stay engaged, and it's easier to get free themselves from their thinking because they can kind of just stay connected to these big physical movements of walking. Some people find the opposite. Some people find that actually it seems to them they think more when they do walking meditation than when they sit. Some people get discouraged when they notice that. But I was taught, don't get discouraged by thinking you're thinking more than when you're doing walking meditation. You might be, but you actually might not be. It's just that sometimes when you sit, meditate, and have your eyes closed, there's less time, time reference points that you have. And so it might seem that there's long spaces between your thoughts, or your thoughts are more spread out, or you're not thinking quite as much. But when you're walking and you have this, you know, one step after the other, there's more of a reference point to notice how often you're thinking. And so you actually might not be thinking any faster or more often in walking meditation than in sitting, but somehow we think we are. So our sensory apparatus doesn't know, it's not always accurate. So it is to walk back and forth, and then drop the attention into the legs, legs and the feet as you walk, the lower legs. In sitting meditation, the focus, the primary kind of center of gravity of attention is where we pay attention is the breath, the alternating sensations of breathing. It's easier to keep the attention present and centered on something that's moving and has a rhythm to it, or alternation with it. So breathing in and breathing out has that alternation. And so it's easier that way than something that's fixed, unmoving. So in walking meditation, the thing that's alternating is the feet as they walk. And so generally we pay attention to the foot that's doing the stepping, and feeling the sensations there, what goes on in that foot. So as the foot leaves the ground, you feel the tightening perhaps of the calf muscles, or you feel the lightening or the stretching of the tendons, maybe in the back of your sole of your feet. You feel the lightening of the foot. And then as you move the foot forward and put it down again, you might feel a different kind of lightening. You feel the contact with the ground. You feel the increasing heaviness as your weight gets shifted over onto your forward foot, and the hardness against the floor. There's a variety of things you feel there. And the idea is just to kind of very, very nicely stay present for the sensations. Some people complain that walking meditation is too pedestrian. It's it's not so spiritual. I mean, the word spiritual has the word breath in it, like respire. And the breath is spiritual, and people give great talks about how wonderful the breath is, and people feel like, oh, I'm doing something spiritual. But then the teacher tells you to pay attention to your feet, the dirty soles of your feet, and there's nothing spiritual about my feet. What's going on here? What's spiritual in Buddhism, if you use that language, is not the object of attention, what you're paying attention to, but it's the act of attention. It doesn't really matter what you're paying attention to. And so what we're using now is we're just using the feet and the legs as the object for the paying of attention, of giving of attention. And then using that alternation and regularity of the feet's walking as a place to strengthen, develop our ability to stay present and to see what's going on. You might say, well, it's pretty boring to look at my feet stepping. It's just these silly sensations. At least when I'm meditating, I'm aware of all kinds of my thoughts, my feelings, and this and that, and it's very exciting in there, but just my feet, As we enter into the world of sensations, after enter into one activity like walking, and our tendency to be distracted or caught up in other things or falls away, and just really right there, full presence for anything is extremely pleasant, very, very satisfying. It becomes kind of compelling in its own right. And you would be amazed how amazingly compelling and interesting the sensations of your feet are when you're concentrated. And it's interesting, not so much because in and of itself, but because the concentrated state that arises from that full engagement, that concentrated state is so compelling, is so wonderful feeling. The sense of power or strength that comes along is very, very compelling. So if we keep judging what we're looking at, the object of attention, like the sensations in the feet, oh, this is boring. If you're judging it that way, then you haven't entered into your feet. You haven't given yourself over to really be present. You're holding yourself a little bit removed. There's some aversion, some resistance going on, some judgments going on. And so to overcome that boredom, you have to kind of allow yourself to really surrender, in a sense, to just this one little activity of stepping. So then we walk about 20 or 30 steps back and forth. And then when you get to the end, if you turn around and can go back and forth. If you're walking at a regular street pace, then most people will just pivot and turn and just keep walk, pivot around and just keep in one continuous movement and keep going. But I find that if you're walking slower than a normal street pace, it's actually very nice to come to the end of your walk, stop, turn around, stop, and then start again. And the stopping gives you a better chance to be mindful, notice what's going on. I've noticed that if I walk continuously like this, that'll mask the continuity of my thinking. Because I have an amazing ability to think, get caught up in my thinking. And I don't even know that I'm thinking because I'm thinking so well. But if I stop, I kind of for a moment there, I kind of get my bearings. Oh, I'm thinking. And then I can let go and turn around and stop and then start. And so by walking 20 paces and then noticing, I'm more likely to start fresh each time and not kind of, be continuously thinking. Sometimes if I'm thinking, a lot, I'll stop in my tracks and just stop And close my eyes and take stock, just noticing, oh, here's thinking, be mindful of that. And then when I'm no longer caught by that, then I'll start walking again. Some people find that as they get into walking meditation, they will naturally walk really, really slow. Sometimes if you ever go on a meditation retreat, there are people who walk so slow, you wonder if they're even walking at all. Not that it's desirable to walk really slow, but it might just be, have a natural feeling that as you get into it more and more, that you'll naturally find yourself wanting to go slower and slower. It's kind of as you get into it more and savor it or feel it. Generally, when we do walking meditation, it's best to have the eyes down about 45 degrees. It's often good to choose a place for walking meditation that there's not a lot of things going on that catches your eyesight, if you can. And just 45 down, degrees down, so you're not kind of looking at things. It's not looking meditation, we're doing walking meditation. And it's also helpful to use the mental noting. So the mental noting is using a very, very simple thought to help you stay present, rather than have your thinking be idle, be do whatever it wants, and it carries you away. So you're giving your thought something to do, but a very, very rudimentary form of thinking, just a simple label. And it can be as simple as labeling stepping, for each step, 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 or it can be right, as the right footsteps, left, as the left footsteps. What's nice about that is that sooner or later you'll notice yourself saying right for the left foot and left for the right foot, and that's an indication that your mindfulness has slipped a little bit and you maybe need to kind of start over again. And then when people walk, when in our tradition, when people walk somewhat slow, there's what's called a three-part step. And that is to note in the mind lifting as the foot goes up, moving as it swings through the air, and then placing as you put it down. Lifting, moving, placing. And that works best when you're walking really slow. If you're walking fast, maybe all you're aware of is a contact of the soles of your feet against the ground. If you're walking really slow, then there's a whole series of subtle sensations you might be aware of as the foot lifts and moves and places. For some people, walking meditation is an acquired taste. It was for me. I didn't really like it for quite some time, but I did it anyway because I've learned that not liking something is not necessarily a reason not to do it. And so I did it, and after a while, now I love it. Now I think it's a great practice, but it took a while to get it. Some people take to it right away. It's a really great practice to learn to do, whether it comes to you naturally or whether it's something that you need to kind of get a taste for. And it really helps in bridging the sitting meditation with our daily life. So that in daily life, if we want to bring mindfulness in daily life, the walking kind of is a nice bridge, because walking is something we do in daily life all the time. And as you get a sense and get a feeling for walking meditation as a formal practice, then it kind of becomes more natural to kind of begin doing it in daily life. And I've had great meditation walking in city streets. I have have to walk many blocks or something. And I just have gotten into this mode sometimes of just, okay, I'm going to do this as a walking meditation. And felt very, very present, calm, connected, mindful. It was a beautiful feeling. And arrived wherever I was going feeling much better than if I had just let my mind be normal or whatever, just whatever it does in its machinations. So what I'd like to do to give you a little bit of experience of what this walking meditation is like is for us to do a kind of an exercise standing. So if you'd all could stand. If for some reason your balance is a little bit hard for you, you can hold on to the edge of a chair if you'd like. So what you want to have is a little bit of space in front of you, so you can take a couple of steps. So if you're in the back row of the chairs, maybe you want to move out or you can be sideways, walk sideways, you know, or something, so that back there. So, and so have your feet, you know, kind of under your shoulders there, and then feel the contact of the soles of your feet with the floor. You, maybe you want to close your eyes and notice if the weight of your body is balanced on both feet and balanced on your feet, so you're not kind of leaning forward, most of your weight is on the balls of your feet or most of your weight is on your heels. You feel yourself, the weight is spread evenly on your feet. If you want, you can open your eyes. Then now, staying as you are, put your attention into your left foot. Just feel your left foot. And then notice how the sensations of your left foot change as you slowly shift most of your weight onto your left foot. And then hold, and notice how the sensations in your left foot differ from the sensations in your right foot. So staying as you are, only shift your attention to your right foot. And with your attention in your right foot, slowly shift your weight now over onto your right foot, noticing the changes in your foot and your lower leg. And then, staying as you are, shift only your attention by putting now your attention into your left foot. And then, keeping your attention in left foot, feeling what happens there, take a small step with your left foot and shift your attention on your weight onto the left foot. And then put your attention on your right foot. And then as your right foot steps forward, feel what happens to the right foot, shifting your weight. Then take your attention to your back foot and noticing how the sensations change as you step forward. Take another step forward. Okay, so why don't you sit down again? So those sensations that you felt in your foot are the world of walking meditation. That's where you enter into that world and feeling those. Whenever you come back and feel those experiences in your foot, you are turning you're not giving your attention to your thinking and being caught in your thoughts. So you're coming back to being present. And you're learning to let go of preoccupation and learn to develop more presence there. We walked the steps here were pretty slow, very slow, so maybe you can be aware of a lot. If you're walking fast, you're not going to be aware of so much subtlety. But that's still the place, the locus of attention is down there in the feet to feel those things. Now, as I said maybe earlier, it takes a while to learn that it's okay or desirable to keep the attention in something as basic as the feet. But I think that as we kind of get into it, you'll learn about the tremendous advantages of concentration, of calm, of stillness, of focus, of mindfulness that comes from cultivating attention as you walk. It's a wonderful way to go about daily life at times. It prepares us for all kinds of things we're going to do. It allows the mindfulness to develop throughout the day in different situations. So I'd recommend that you try it. Some people find it very helpful to do some walking meditation before they do sitting meditation. In fact, my teacher in Burma, my meditation teacher, he kind of was very strict with me when I was in Burma. He said, "Gil, never do sitting meditation before without first doing walking meditation." And so I in Burma, I always did that. When I came back for a number of years, I always started with 10 minutes of walking meditation before I did sitting meditation. And some people find that very useful. So it's more movement. Some people are more kinesthetic. Some people, movement kind of works better for them to feel connected. And once they're more connected, it's sit down to meditate in the sitting posture. So that's kind of a basic introduction to walking meditation. I have a handout for you about walking meditation you're welcome to have here. But now it's your turn. Do you have any questions about that? Yes.
It was sort of more related to previous.
Sure, please.
In your guided meditation, you mentioned like opening up, Like, and I noticed that through the meditation process of doing more intensively, I feel like I have this, like I'm more open, and I feel more. And, which is sometimes good, but not always. Because, I feel like I'm more, that it's like, if you get your feelings hurt, whatever, it hurts more, and it's just more distracting, especially if you're in a meditation or if you're being mindful and you're aware that you're feeling more or feeling more than it's comfortable. And I find that's distracting. It's distracting because, I'm aware that it's very self-centered, sort of thing.
Right.
It's like, oh, poor me, whatever. That feels, I didn't like that, or that was disrespectful or whatever. Right. As I was working, as I was ruminating about that, I realized, I was able to, it lifted some, and I was able to sort of just focus on that feeling. And I felt that that it actually lessened that whole experience.
Right. Beautiful. So I think you did exactly what I would have instructed. That is, if you feel in you're being more open or more present, you feel that things are stronger in a way that's uncomfortable for you, It helps to kind of bring your attention to try to pinpoint the best you can where the place of discomfort is. Because it might not be the whole show, but it might be a particular aspect of it. There might be a little bit of fear around it. There might be some judgment about it. There might be some involvement with it really is a source of the discomfort. It might not be the intensity of the feelings, the problem. It might be something else. It might be the self-referential ideas. This is embarrassing. I'm in a meditation center and I'm supposed to be calm and here I am agitated. Being agitated is not the problem, but it's the relationship we have with it. So to look and see what's actually the source of the stress that's going on, what's the source of the distress that's happening. And sometimes you can start to tease apart to find more details. Some people find that meditation practice will at times make them more acutely aware, stronger. Things become stronger, more acute, more clear. And sometimes it's quite beautiful. The food tastes more clearly, stronger. You go outside and you see your environment in a much more clear, crisp way than you did before. So, wow, I had no idea it was so beautiful here. Wow, the leaves are shining. And sometimes feelings and thoughts can be much more acutely, much more acuteness around them as well. And it can feel really great. Sometimes, as we meditate, there are some inner things that don't feel comfortable become much more strong. Sometimes they become stronger because we're more aware of them than we were before. And sometimes the awareness is like having opened like a door, and they come flooding up in a stronger way. They actually become stronger because we made space for them. Maybe they've been held at bay for a long time. And so there's a transition period as we kind of deal with the backlog of strong emotions need to come up. And sometimes as we meditate, there are certain feelings and emotions and things that actually get calmer when we meditate. because we're not so involved or invested in them. So there might be, someone might be angry about something. And the usual way is when we're angry is we get into feeling justified and defending ourselves in anger, and we kind of just work up steam and we feel pretty intensely. But when we meditate, you just let anger be anger. You don't think about it. You don't think the story about that no good, lousy guy. And so it's not being fed. And it's actually the emotions are still there, but they get much more calm. You know, they don't get so dramatic. So all of the above happens. And so I would encourage you that if you find that in being more open and present in meditation, your feelings and stuff become more strong and more intense, be very accepting of that. It's fine. And it's your task then is to be more mindful of that and discover what's going on in a deeper way. And I'm confident that if you bring mindfulness to that, you'll find that it's quite workable and probably, you know, very meaningful for you to go through it. Is that clear enough?
Yeah, there's a lot.
There's a lot. I apologize if I talk. Sometimes I have so much to say. It's an occupational hazard. Yes?
I actually have two questions, but I'll ask one of them first, and then if there is time, the second one. You mentioned for walking meditation not to look, because it's not a looking meditation. I'm having a hard time, by the way, getting myself to sit down and meditate, so I try to take advantage of, like, washing dishes or when I'm exercising. So generally when I walk, it's for exercise. And for that, I usually do it at a park. And at this park, there are sights and sounds. And my question is, since the bottom line, the whole idea is developing mindfulness, i.e. developing paying attention and sustaining attention, which was one of your subjects a couple of weeks ago. What is wrong with, or is that maybe cheating? What is wrong with, like, if something else catches our attention while walking, and generally there are things that catch my attention when I'm walking, a cute little bird or a cute little child running or whatever, sights and sounds of nature.
Right.
What's wrong with paying the attention to whatever that is happening, like the bird or the child or the nature, and sustaining the attention on that?
Nothing wrong with it at all. I think if you're going to do walking meditation in a park like that, then probably what you should do is walking and looking meditation.
Walking and looking. So that is still a meditation? That's not cheating?
No. You can do a meditation in any, you know. Meditation is basically being present for what your experience is.
Exactly.
But present in a careful, mindful way.
Sure.
So if you see something beautiful, a beautiful flower, you're still seeing. You're not starting thinking about, how can I cut that flower and bring it home, and that'd be nice, and how would it look in a flower arrangement? And then you're not meditating and being mindful. But it's, just seeing, and feeling the pleasure of it, and seeing. Keep it really simple. Mm. So when you're walking in a park, which is such a big, can be a busy place,
right?
If you're trying to kind of stay kind of focused and narrow on just the feet walking, you probably just get uptight.
Exactly.
And that's not what Buddhism is, the opposite of getting uptight.
Yeah.
So I would then just relax and just, okay, and I guess I'm doing walking and seeing meditation, or maybe just seeing meditation, forget about the walking.
I don't even label, like, if I see, like, a little animal, a little baby something eating their lunch or dinner or whatever, I just get so absorbed into just watching. It's, I guess, that my mind stops even thinking. I'm like, look at this.
Yeah, but then you're not mindful. So if what you want to do, it's a fine thing to do, but if what you want to do is develop mindfulness, you have to have enough presence of mind. So you could say, I know that I know. I'm watching the squirrel, and I know that I'm watching the squirrel. There's that kind of self-reflection, that kind of ability, that level of self-possession or presence of mind, where you know that you're present. And if you're completely involved in it, and so much so that you kind of, 15 minutes later, where am I? You know, what's going on here? You know, that's not meditation. That's not mindfulness. That's being lost.
No, I know what I'm doing, actually. I don't get lost. I know what I'm doing, but I just basically try. I actually tell myself, see if you can practice paying attention
Great, beautiful.
To what's in front of you right now, right here. Beautiful. So that's okay then.
Sure, why wouldn't it be?
Now, in terms of the leg, the exercise that we just did, yeah. which could be, I guess, if there is nothing to catch my attention, if I'm going to be paying attention to the feet. With walking, actually, it's easier to pay attention to one at a time. But like when we were standing for exercise and you said, pay attention to the left or the right, I was having a hard time focusing only on one. As hard as I tried to pay attention to only the right or the left, both of them were catching my attention.
That's fine.
That's okay.
You know, you don't have to. You know, it's best when you do mindfulness meditation to begin with the assumption it's all fine, as opposed to beginning with the assumption that there's a right way and I'm doing the wrong way. Is this wrong? To start with, this is how it is for me. I'm aware of two things at once. I'm aware of the left and the right foot. But you know, that's how I do it. But the instruction was to pay attention to the right foot. So, you know, 70% of my attention is there, 30% is on the right, you know, and then, you know, it'll have to be good enough. I'm more relaxed about it.
Thank you.
So it's 9:00. So thank you very much. And if you have any more questions, you're welcome to come and up and ask me. And I hope you get a lot of benefit and joy from cultivating and developing mindfulness in your life. Thank you.